Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. In the late 1960s, southeastern Michigan was rocked by the terrifying serial murders of young women whose bodies were dumped in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. In each case, few clues were left at the scene, and six separate police agencies were unable to end the horror. Then, almost by accident, a break came. The suspect, John Norman Collins, a young, quiet, all-American boy. Collins was one of the first serial killers exposed in the region, and his arrest had many in the area locking their doors for the first time. Edward Keyes's harrowing The Michigan Murders covers every step of the case. It fell out of print for more than a decade before being revived for this special edition. Edward Keyes, now deceased, spent several years in the early 1970s investigating the Michigan murders. He also authored the works Double Dare and Coconut Grove. The Michigan murders won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Fact Crime in 1977. Here we speak with his son, Edward J. Keyes, about the murders and the book, The Michigan Murders. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
Why do you think these murders so completely captivated local interest?
You know, the community at the time, during this horrible period in the Michigan history, if we look back at what was happening during that time in the 60s, how there was so much of a revolt, particularly of the status quo of young people on campus, of younger people that were coming out of maybe out of the Second World War and that were growing, had families, there was a whole different feeling about where young people belonged, what their identities were. So here in the towns of Ann Arbor, which was the seat of the University of Michigan, and the neighboring city of Ypsilanti that had Eastern Michigan University, what we found was that in that period of time, there was a sense of unrest that was taking hold because of the change and the shift from the status quo to kind of the what ended up becoming the 60s. So here in the small towns of Ypsilanti, Ann Arbor, and the surrounding, there were still farms. And when these murders took hold with unspeakable savagery, as it turned out, the communities, the families, the victims, the neighbors, the shopkeepers, the people at the schools, it was almost unthinkable that they could not solve these crimes. Initially, it was horrible and scary to consider that there was a murderer in the midst. And that kind of morphed into a sense of anger and outrage. And how could over 2 years this horrible person or persons have been allowed to get away with all this? So there was a lot of backlash against the law enforcement communities, which wasn't fair at all because they did everything they possibly could to find this killer. And so I think that this was a defining moment in the 60s, not a moment, but series of moments that helped to change and to solidify the evolution of our culture, of our society, of the consciousness of the young people, and of course, older folks as well. There's so much more to that, but I'd say that this was part of the great change and the shift in our culture, away from a safe-minded, almost a carefree existence, into one that ultimately was caused people to be a lot more careful about themselves and a lot more maybe suspicious of others, if you would.
What do you find most interesting about the way the case played out?
Well, the case itself was very unique and interesting in that because the murders happened within a 20 to 30 square mile area between the two universities, Eastern Michigan U in Ypsilanti and the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and that most of those areas were somewhat rural. There were cornfields and there were other farmlands, and then, of course, there were the cities with the two universities that were there, and they were linked by young people and then all of the kind of the infrastructure supporting university and college life. And what happened was, ultimately, we find out that over 2 years, these seven different co-eds, ranging in age from 13 up to mid-20s, 23, I believe, one by one disappeared, and their remains were found in just horrible, savage ways. So all of this gave rise to a sense by the people in the community that this had to have been done and perpetrated by somebody outside of the area. How can anybody conceive that there was a killer who would do such horrible things to our own family members, friends, whatever? And so as the case played out, the perpetrator ended up, I'm not giving the story away, but it ended up being one of the very people who lived and worked and visited and was friends with many of the victims, the victims' families who worked in the community, and no one knew. No one knew it was him. Coincidentally, and even maybe more ironically, that he was related to one of the officers of the Michigan State Police, a fine organization, by the way, who did everything they could to try and track down, capture, and end this crazy mania of fear and killing. They eventually did so, and there was a long, drawn-out court case. The perpetrator, who was ultimately convicted and jailed, and by the way, still alive that we know of, was only accused of one of the seven crimes for various reasons that whoever reads the book will find out through the trial process. But my father was writing the book and did extensive research on the legal system and how it worked and how to bring evidence to a trial, how cross-examination was conducted, all the nuances of finding evidence, and it's really an exquisitely done and very well-researched story about how this all happened. So the case was unusual in several different ways, and but not least of which is that it was the killer was somebody in their own communities, and was related to one of the law enforcement organizations within that community.
What do you think these crimes in the court case did to change the way, you know, people perceived the area?
The entire story of how a community kind of morphed and grew and evolved from maybe more of a carefree, easy, consumption-based society where everybody kept their doors unlocked and gave rides to hitchhikers and, you know, didn't think twice about somebody invading their privacy or, God forbid, capturing one of their own children. All of that sense of security changed over this couple of years period of time. And I think that the events that led up to this story concluding and then this murderer who was one of their own being put away, and then all the horror and the I don't want to go back to the savagery of how these young women were treated and killed. It literally changed people's perception of who they were in the world and who their neighbors were, who their community people, who other people were in relation to them. So that was also during a time when the Vietnam War really started to escalate in the end of the 60s, and there was great revolt in our communities across our country having to do with civil rights, having to do with women's liberation. A great rift was being created, and there were both sides, and each side, there were probably multiple sides, multiple points of view, but each of the people on those sides or taking those positions felt legitimate in what they believed where the country was going as a whole. It seemed like society was fracturing. Now, this is a very small case, obviously, not for the families involved or for all the people who endured the calamities, but certainly it was one of many, many things that were going on across our nation, well, naturally across the world, as human beings, as our consciousness was expanding. So I think I'm looking at it, I kind of telescope out and look at it from a much larger perspective, and then we can drill back down into the details of this particular two-year period of time, and we find we're in the midst of tremendous change in many, many ways, and not least of which was how people treated one another after that. The doors were locked, a lot more suspicion, there was a lot more careful analysis of where my child's going. But that was the feeling that shifted, is that people took more responsibility for one another based on the sense of fear and the sense of they might lose one of their own.
So let's go back and talk about your father. What role did this book play in his life? And did you ever hear about it while you were growing up?
Yeah, my dad was a pretty amazing guy. He had started as a newspaper reporter for one of the local dailies, sports reporter initially, and then a newspaper reporter for one of the New York City newspapers. And then he ended up fathering eight children, but we grew up with seven kids. And Dad grew a lot during the period of having kids, and so we used to kid him about, we were the ones that helped make him who he was, but he'd have no part of that. He was a very strong-willed man, and his father literally changed his family name from Kaiser, which is what my grandfather's name was, Edward Kaiser, changed his family name to Keys, and changed his religion from from what he was born in, Lutheran, to Catholic. Now, this was back in the 19-teens. Subsequently, his family disowned him. Now, the reason I'm saying that is that it gave rise to a sense of independence, a sense of self, and maybe a greater sense of being independent, which I think my father took from his father. And so Dad got involved with writing the book, The French Connection, with Robin Moore. Robin Moore was a prolific author, well-known, wrote The Country Team and The Green Berets, which became a major motion picture with John Wayne, etc. So Robin Moore and my dad wrote The French Connection together. As it turns out, Dad wrote most of The French Connection, 85% or more. But that's okay. Robin Moore's name is on that book. The reason I'm mentioning that is it gave rise to Dad then doing research on the story, the Michigan murders. And he did extensive research. He spent nearly 3 years writing this book, which, for many authors in today's world, it's almost ridiculous not to have a book come out every 3 months. But for 3 years, he worked on and spent 6 months at a time in Michigan working on this, doing the research, and all the different families that would have interviews, not all of them would speak to him. This was at a time when there was some success from The French Connection, and this was Dad's solo flight as an author. And when he would write, it's interesting, as a family, Dad would be the first one up in the morning, and he'd get us all off to school, and then he'd go up to his little office on the second floor of our house. And if we were around at all during the day, we'd hear him tapping behind his closed door on his manual typewriter. And in many cases, he would write out drafts and then type them up. He even had my sister Dara do some typing for him of the Michigan murders. Sidebar, kind of humorous, is that later Dara would tell us that she was not a very good typist, and the fact is she got so engrossed in the story that she spent too much time reading through the story and not enough time finishing the typing so that Dad could present it to the editors. So she was summarily fired. She chuckles about that now. But interestingly, my mother was the one who would read the chapters after my father would finish compiling his research and putting together his dialogue and putting the show notes into an editable format. And he would give my mother the chapters to read before he had the next one ready. And in almost every chapter, I have it in front of me now, it's almost a cliffhanger on nearly every end of every chapter. Well, Mom would just be beside herself. You know what it's like when you get to the end of a chapter and all of a sudden you're at this place where you're hanging over a cliff, you can't wait to continue, and there was no next chapter. And so that was always kind of the history of our family, at least as far as this project was concerned. His writing style is very conversational in the dialogue, very dramatic in the setup of the scenes, very multidimensional in how the dialogue is introduced into the factual parts of the scene. You could tell that there are characters who are thinking multiple different things about what was happening there. It's fascinating to read. It's a terrific book. I don't mind saying it's one of my favorites of all time.
What do you think of the Michigan murders being re-released?
The Keys family is absolutely delighted to have the Michigan murders be re-released by the University of Michigan Press. It's a real honor to the work that my father did. And we believe that this is one of his greater achievements in his life, as he would claim himself. He left us and passed on in 2002, and he didn't really get the kind of recognition or the accolades for the work that he had done with the French Connection, with the Michigan murders, with the subsequent book Double Dare, and with his book Coconut Grove. And we just believe that this story is so good. We're very proud of it. And we hadn't thought about it for many years until we were contacted by the University of Michigan Press about doing a re-release. And we're absolutely delighted.
Well, Ed, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us about your father's book.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk about the Michigan murders. It's part of our family history, and I know a lot of people will appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Edward J. Keyes, son of Edward Keyes, author of The Michigan Murders. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.